concept, which all pharmacologists are familiar with and which you should be too if you're going to deal in this realm, called LD50. This is not a pretty notion, but a necessary one. It stands for lethal dose 50. What does this mean? It means if we have 100 mice, how much psilocybin do we have to give each mouse to kill half of them? Do you see? LD50. Half the sample dies at the LD50 dose level, whether it's graduate students or rats. Now, when you're designing a drug, or when you're thinking about a drug, what you want is a drug with an extremely high LD50 opposed to its effective dose. So say the effective dose of psilocybin is probably about 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. And the LD50 is probably 200 milligrams per kilogram. The LD50 of psilocybin is 400 times the effective dose. This is a pharmacologist's way of saying this is very, very safe. A pound wouldn't kill you, I don't think. It might be getting close, but you'd have to eat in that range to die. Now, some drugs have horrendous LD50 to effective dose profiles. Unfortunately, and I hope I don't rain on anybody's parade here, MDMA has a terrible LD50 profile. The effective dose is 125 milligrams. You can kill yourself with 1,000 milligrams. So that's not good at all. Because sure as hell, some street person or some depressed person or some maniac is going to take 1,000 milligrams. And then you've got a stiff on your hands. So, yeah.
I recently read some info on MDMA indicating that serotonin, depressed serotonin levels on MDMA, the serotonin stays low in your body for about a week after taking it, whereas like a related substance called E, the serotonin levels are depressed for only 2 hours. And the researcher indicated that his conclusion was that MDMA had some physiological toxicity that E did not have, and therefore it might be wise to avoid it for that reason.
Well, in fact, I've read an article that destroying the serotonin receptor sites in the brain.
I thought about liver tests before and after. I was at 300 milligrams.
There was a difference. Well, I think MDMA is, I don't want to trash MDMA. It's changed a lot of people's lives and saved relationships and so forth and so on. But to me, it's a perfect example of why you're better off taking plants. Because here was this drug, somebody invented it. They gave it to a few friends. It seemed to be wonderful for solving personal problems. So without any collection of human data, this thing becomes an item in the underground. Well, and so then thousands of people take it. The psychological effects seem completely benign. It's a wonderful thing. The physiological effects, it's a very disturbing profile. It isn't exactly as you said. It's not that it destroys the serotonin receptor site. It's that nerves, neurons, are covered by these very delicate structures called dendritic spines. Now, nobody knows what dendritic spines do, but every neuron in your body has them. And when you take MDMA, it mows them down. They go away. Now, so then you get two schools of thought. One says, well, my God, anything impacting the physical brain that dramatically should be stayed away from. And the other camp says, well, do you see any behavioral changes in people who take MDMA a lot? Do you see any physical destruction, seizures, blindness, anything? And the answer is no. So they say, well, Here we have histological evidence that this thing is making major physiological changes in the dendrites, and no behavioral sequela to back up that this is of any consequence. Well, my position, being basically a very conservative person, is in that case, wait. You know, they're doing work on this in a dozen labs around the country. They'll figure it out. In the meantime, take psilocybin or mescaline or something else that has been sanctioned, because you just do not want to insult the physical brain. You know, that's the whole name of the game. You have to keep the brain in good shape. Yeah.
Could we go back to his question? Once you're past the trigger dose, is it worthwhile to start to step up? To
oh, yeah. That's where we were talking. That's why we started talking about LD50, because I wanted to explain to you that taking a drug like a compound like psilocybin, if the effective dose is 20 milligrams for somebody who weighs 135 pounds, well, then looking at the pharmacological data, they should be able to take 2,000 milligrams without any trouble at all. That's 1,000. That's 100 times more. But in fact, what happens is, as you raise the dose, is that the psychological presentation becomes unbearable. It becomes so strange that you fear for your sanity, in a good old Edgar Allan Poe-ish phrase, you know. It gets stranger and stranger. And, you know, I've talked to pretty naive people who have overdosed. Usually the way these overdose situations occur is people are gathering mushrooms in the wild and they start eating them. And then they just keep eating them. And then they realize they've eaten four times more than the effective dose. And this is where you get into places where you don't know what to say, because if you tell people, they'll throw a net over you. But you want to say, because you're so personally disturbed. This is where the flying saucers land and the rectal examinations begin, and you're told that you're the Messiah, and they, you know, it becomes quirkier and quirkier. So I think you have to, you know, I'm very admiring of people who can take very high doses, but I find it quite challenging enough in the 5 to 7 gram range. A friend of mine says of psilocybin that every time he takes it, he tries to stand more, meaning more of the vision, because it is filtering itself. It's definitely filtering itself. This is why beginners almost never have bad trips, because somebody in there looks at your clipboard and says, oh, this guy has never done this before, so lay off the rough stuff. Just, you know, bring him through the standard number. It's the people who consider themselves experienced, you know, who've done it 20, 30, 40 times, says, you know, we can take the gloves off with this guy. And in, you know, it always amazes me. I sometimes meet people who say, you know, I've taken mushrooms 50 times and I've never had a bad trip. And I think, you know, lucky soul. Because when it goes left, it's hard. You know, it's hard. You have to really then, you know, do not your mantras bungle is the best advice I can give you, because you need to steer back toward the mainstream. Now, maybe at this point, this is a good point at which to talk about what do you do when the going gets rough. There are two things, at least, that you can do that are very effective. The first is, and it's a very simple thing, but people in our culture seem to be resistant to this, is you sing. You force air into your lungs and body, and you chant. You sing anything you want, and it will radically alter the parameters. There's a certain place in psilocybin that is my bête noire, which I call the meat locker. and I don't like this place, you know. And meat locker is a mild term for it. It's more like, you know, the morgue for the homicide unit or something. Whenever I start drifting that way, I sing. And then you can navigate through it. The other thing you can do, although this is sometimes trickier, is smoke cannabis. This is what those bombers are for that you rolled in the first hour while you were waiting for it to come on. Is as soon as it begins to press in some really invasive or alarming way, just take a couple of hits of the good and chant, and then you can bring it back on track. And also talk to it. Don't be afraid to say, you know, I don't like this. Take it off me. It's too peculiar. I'm not ready for this. It says, oh, sorry, you know, back to dancing mice. Yeah.
Do different batches of mushrooms have wildly varying concentrations of psilocybin?
Well, there hasn't been a lot of work on this. Michael Buckley at Evergreen College years ago grew Stropharia cubensis by the method that's described in my book, the book I wrote with my brother. And what they discovered, see, psilocybin is 4-phosphoryl-oxy-N,N-dimethyltryptamine. That phosphorus group is removed as soon as it crosses the blood-brain barrier. So really, what's active is a simpler compound called psilocin. And psilocin lacks the phosphorus attachment. And what they discovered was that in the early flushes, the psilocybin ratio is high and the psilocin ratio is low. And in the, you all know what a flush is, right? And in the later flushes, the psilocin level rises and the psilocybin level drops, so really the two together stay remarkably stable throughout the life of the organism. Something worth mentioning, I suppose it's worth mentioning, is when I was into my extraterrestrial phase, when I was assuming that the mushroom was an extraterrestrial, either the extraterrestrial itself or something designed by some kind of an extraterrestrial, it was very interesting to me that psilocybin is, as I said, 4-phosphoryl-oxy-N,N-dimethyltryptamine. It is the only 4-substituted indole in nature. The only one. Well, if you were to search for evidence of extraterrestrial tampering with the biome of this planet, what you would look for is a unique compound occurring in one life form and no other. Here it is, folks. This phosphorus group is unique, and I've never read any description or discussion of what the evolutionary history of that, why it would appear in an organism like that and not in any other. That's just an aside, because I'm always searching for the thumbprint of the alien. There may not be an alien thumbprint, but the phosphorus group attached to psilocybin is a good candidate for it. Yeah.
Switching the subject only slightly, the descriptions that you've given of all of these experiences, although you have said that it varies widely, there's a remarkable internal consistency of your descriptions, that you're entering a world that seems to have boundaries and entities that you consistently encounter again and again. I've spoken to many people over the years, some of whom have known you a long time. And nobody I've ever spoken to, people who've taken high doses or low doses, have ever had similar experiences. Now, clearly you've talked to people who have. So I'm wondering...
Maybe they were just being polite.
I'm wondering if you've ever experimented with your own experiences, like what Lily describes in programming and metaprogramming, and to see, you describe ways of evoking
entity, which certainly could be put into a context of introducing programs into your experience.
True.
Have you worked with different presuppositions going into this to see what the limits are?
Well, my original presupposition was to try to have no presupposition at all. And then out of that came all of these assumptions. You're right that nobody has trips exactly like mine. Although, if you question people carefully, you can begin to see how it works. For example, I described this thing this morning, the elves, the presentational thing, the high-speed motion, the gifts, all that. Well, sometimes people will take DMT and they will come back and you'll realize that it's as though there is an archetype there which has different levels in it. And if I had to say what the archetype of DMT is, it's the archetype of the circus. And one time I saw a woman come out of DMT. She was an anthropologist. She had fairly high body weight. And I could tell that she had not gotten a complete hit. Came down. We said, okay, what was it? She said, it was the saddest carnival in the world. She said the carnival was closed. All the tents had their flaps rolled down, and there were just paper cups and candy wrappers blowing in the aisles in between them, and the Ferris wheel was stopped. Well, she was just at the edge of this thing, and if you think about the archetype of the circus, it is an interesting one. First of all, you have the three center rings where wild and zany activity is continuously being presented. Tiny cars keep arriving with 14 clowns in each one, and they keep climbing out, falling all over each other. But it isn't all fun and games. It has a strange erotic content. And as a child, I think my first awareness of what I would really call eros was watching this beautiful long-haired woman in a tiny spangled costume hang by her teeth 120 feet above the center ring doing acrobatics. So you've got... So you've got the clown and you've got the lady in the tiny spangled costume, and then off from the center ring, you have these dark alleyways where the sideshows are. The Siamese twins and the goat boy and all the rest of it, you know. And it has a very weird vibe about it. So it can land you in any of these places. But if you try and correlate people's experiences, it seems to me that it's pretty clear that through their own life history and their own programming, nevertheless, something is trying to poke through. Now, my DMT experience seems pretty radically different from other people's, although other people don't give any account at all. I mean, it's amazing how inarticulate people are. They come down, you say, how was it? And they say, it was far out. You say, you know, you don't get out of here with that rap. You know, how was it? And you say, well, they can't give a good account. On psilocybin, I think most people experience something very much like what I describe. Huge machines, a sense of danger to the earth, apocalyptic visions, the idea that someone will come and help. And I'm pretty resistant to all the flotsam and jetsam of the New Age. I mean, I don't spend a moment worrying about the exact physical location of Atlantis or stuff like that. And I think people, it inflates their personal mythologies and intellectual misconceptions, but there is something trying to get through. That's why this exercise show me what you are for yourself is really a good one. And maybe my trips are so weird because I have always worshipped weirdness. So I can go further down that road without being alarmed while somebody else, would pull back. One of the problems is that we don't have complete maps of these places. At this stage in exploring that new world, what we have essentially are the scribbled diaries of frightened explorers. And we don't know if Explorer A is talking about the same river system as Explorer B, or whether they were on opposite sides of the planet or the universe. Building a coherent picture of the psychedelic dimension would be the first challenge to a rational approach to understanding it.
Have you ever read Far Journeys by Robert Monroe?
Is that the first book?
No.
No, I read the first book.
Well, it actually is a map. Talk about weird. This is one of the weirdest things you would ever read. But it has an amazing ring of truth in it. And in it, he presents a map of all of the realms of beings that exist that he's visited, just normal consciousness. It's almost an anti-psychedelic description. But it's pretty consistent with some of the things you were discussing this morning, because this is where you go when you die. And it's also where you go when you sleep. In fact, he talks about classes you attend in your sleep. And he describes these levels upon levels of entities coexisting. And he describes it like a hiccup happens to be dropping in at this.
Well, I read the first book, and I was puzzled by how much of it didn't seem familiar to me. Like, I remember in the first book he talks about a world that's just like this world, except the cars are 9 feet wide. That would be a very puzzling psychedelic experience to go to that world. I knew someone who was very close to him, and I don't want to set off any lawsuits here, but I once cornered this person and said, "So what about it?" And he said, "Don't worry, you don't have to worry. This is not getting close to your bailiwick at all." Buddhism of the Mahayanas has a tremendously complex system of levels and entities. Wrathful Buddhas and Dharmapalas and peaceful entities. And I think that that's pretty interesting as a phenomenological description of mind. I reject the philosophical premise of Buddhism because I think it's, an unbelievably uncompromising kind of nihilism. But Buddhism, as it's pitched in America, soft pedals that a lot. You know, they don't present it as a form of nihilism, but I think ultimately it is, in the most positive sense. But still, I'm of the school that follows Alfred North Whitehead, who said, "Say what you may, there are certain stubborn facts." And, you know, that's not a very Buddhist point of view. Yeah.
Do you have visions on cannabis, too?
If I can control myself and not do it too often. The problem is cannabis does so many other wonderful things, and I tend to use it for those other wonderful things. But if I were totally dedicated to vision, then I would only smoke once a week, because then you completely come to equilibrium. And then, I think people do it not wrong, but not the way you should do it if you want visions. You should do it the way you do all these other things, alone in silent darkness and at high doses. Bursts of hallucination on cannabis are hard to control and predict, but sometimes they're as intense as anything can be. If you read 19th century descriptions of cannabis use by people like Fitzhugh Ludlow and the Club du Hashashin and that crowd, where they were eating the hashish, it's very clear that it was the LSD of the 19th century. I mean, nobody can read those descriptions without realizing these people were loaded for sure. They were thoroughly and completely smashed to be able to write those kinds of accounts. Yeah, go ahead.
Said you could smoke a lot at the start of the mushroom trip. And when I smoke a lot at the start of the trip, it tend to really confuse entering them. And that's what I kind of realized. It has an effect which, I'm not sure that's a good effect in terms of getting the learning, shall we say, from the Mokala chemicals.
Well, you didn't exactly make clear to me what the effect was. It fuzzes you out going into...
Well, it depends on what you smoke. I suppose if you have a very top-grade sense of me, it will be one thing. If you smoke Colombian, it will be something totally different.
What it does to me is it just slightly cuts my anxiety. You know, I'm able to let the thing unfold of its own. I don't know. I mean, I have a lifelong, intense relationship to cannabis. And I basically make my living out of being able to do feats of memory. And, you know, cannabis is supposed to trash your memory. So I don't, maybe I'm different, but I resist any maybe I'm different argument because it's malarkey. Nobody's different enough that they can,
In terms of your articulateness and memory recall, when you're at the peak of the kind of experience, does it still, speak as clearly then? I get really tongue-tied.
No, more so. My great dream is that as my powers of locution fade with old age, that cannabis will be legalized. Then I can sit in front of you and smoke, and my career can be pushed 20 years further into the future. The way I use cannabis is to think, and I do a lot of thinking. I do a lot, and at night before I go to bed, I smoke, and then I play the tapes of the day, and then I understand what happened. If I didn't have cannabis, I don't think I would be sort of at sea or a kind of a space case, because I never get what somebody really meant, really intended, really had in mind, till I play the tapes stoned, and then I see, aha, that's what the agenda was, or that's what was going on.
Sleep afterwards?
Oh, yeah. And if I don't smoke, then I'm insomniac. Yeah.
I don't know how far you want to go with all this, but I'm really interested in how you compare that's one and also the experience with the other drugs you talked about. How do you complete that?
Okay, well, LSD, again, you remember, I'm only speaking for myself because there is no other way to approach it. I found LSD very interesting, but ultimately kind of frustrating because I wanted visions. And to me, what LSD by itself does is it does a lot of slippery and hard to name stuff. It accelerates and changes the quality of thought. Basically that's it. It does something to the quality of thought. But I had been reading Aldous Huxley and Havelock Ellis and those people, and I kept saying, where are the ruins of alien civilizations? Where are the jeweled tapestries? And then, fiddling around with LSD, I discovered that if I would take it with mescaline, then it became the psychedelic experience that I was seeking. But in and of itself, it's kind of psychoanalytic. It's sort of like cleaning up your act. It often focuses you on your own personal stuff. And, I have to confess to you, I'm not that interested in my own personal stuff, probably because it's so horrendous. But I don't like personalized trips. I like cosmic vision information trips. And then mescaline, mescaline is, you have to take a lot to get it to really do what you want it to do. And it being an amphetamine has not a very good LD50 profile. It's not like MDMA, where 10 times the effective dose and you're in real trouble, but probably 40 times the effective dose and you'd be sweating bullets. So, and then just the nature of my life, I've not had as much to do with mescaline as these other things. I'm really a vision freak. And people say, you know, well, there's feeling and there's insight and there's this and that. But the reason I'm so fixated on vision, or the excuse I give, somebody said it's because you're a double Scorpio. But to me, it's the proof that it's not coming from me. I can come up with insights. I can come up with funny ideas. But I can't come up with objects never before seen by the human eye or mind. And so when the visions start, then I feel this is the transpersonal part of the trip. This isn't my unconscious, my memories, my fears, my hopes. This is something else. Yeah.
Last night you were talking about boundary dissolution and ego reduction. And what you described this morning, I mean, how do they relate?
How do boundary dissolution and...
How do your descriptions of the trip this morning relate particularly to ego?
Well, I think in very practical terms, they show you that everything you know is wrong. You know? I mean, how can the ego survive that piece of information? It just puts in your lap incontrovertible evidence that everything you ever thought or believed is hokum. And that's extraordinarily humbling. And that word, humbling, means the feeling you have when your ego is reduced. You know, humble yourself enough and you'll begin to feel humiliated. And, you know, that's a deeper ego reduction. I think aside from any magical chemical effect they might have on ego, they're just simply showing you the true size of the universe and your place in it. And, you know, in our down personal lives, every man, every woman, a king or a queen, I mean, we build castles in the air, our career, our children, our whatever. Well, then you get into those places, you just say, you know, how preposterous.
This is a dangerous kind of question,
maybe,
but is there any gender difference in experience?
For men and women?
Male ego being...
Well, that's an interesting question.
I'm interested in that also in terms of the history.
Yeah. You mean what we talked about last night?
Yeah, religion being perhaps a male created...
Well, I think women, by virtue of the fact that they menstruate and give birth, are just inherently more chemically driven creatures than men. Men are Apollonian in intent. The idea is always some kind of abstract purity, clarity kind of thing. And women know from the get-go that that's an illusion. That the reality is the floor of the rainforest, the interconnected tissue, the levels, the trade-offs, and so forth and so on. This is why I think generally men tend to be more interested in these things than women, and to also be more impacted by them. For women, it seems to sort of fit in and affirm what they knew. For men, it seems to come as a tremendous surprise that this is the way things are put together. I think that if everybody gave birth and experienced menstruation, probably we never would have launched ourselves into history. In a way, you know, without going too far with it, men are the ancillary sex. I mean, the original blastula in the embryonic development is female. And I was listening to somebody the other night talk about this, saying no wonder men have the problems they have. What a man is a woman who has been under incredible chemical assault for 9 months in the womb. and you just have been hammered, sculpted, shaped, and recast again and again, and then you're born male. A female fetus doesn't experience anything like that. It starts out with a smooth shot at its end phylogenetic expression and then achieves it. I don't think of the ego as particularly male, because I think we all have it to excessive degrees, but men are able to express it. A woman with an ego is frustrated. A man with an ego is a menace to all concerned, you know. So, yeah.
How do you feel about taking a trip with another or other people? Do you think the question of energy and personalities changes your trip?
I think it's a very major decision to do that, that if you're going to take a high dose of psychedelics with somebody else, then you better be prepared to get all entangled with them, which can be great. It can also be fairly confusing. I don't like taking psychedelics. This is not an issue of entanglement. That's sort of what goes on between lovers or close friends. But I get a lot of requests to sit for people, and I don't do it because I don't know whether it's my personality or what it is, but I am unable to contain my anxiety in the presence of another stoned person, especially if I'm stoned. If I'm stoned and they're stoned and we're in a dark room, I cannot get off. I listen to them breathe. I worry. I wonder if I should ask them if they're all right. Then I go off on long trips about not interrupting them. And then that loops back into, but I haven't heard them breathe for 20 minutes. And I'm always afraid. I don't know. So really, people say, doesn't it take courage to do it alone? For me, it takes more courage to do it with people, because inevitably then you get tangled up into some kind of craziness. And, you know, you can think you're having a telepathic experience, and they've decided that they want to have sex or something, and meanwhile, I've just had a revelation about that entry Molière made in his diary when he was talking to his niece Agnes about the nature of the French comic theater. And so you say, boy, you know, we've got too much on the menu here. But I'm weird. Remember that. Yeah.
Okay. Now, and we have heard about the common vision shared by people in ayahuasca. So can you comment on this kind of thing and contrast it to what you're talking about with the human head of the mushroom?
You mean the group mind on ayahuasca?
Yeah. And is that possible?
Oh, yeah. No, it's very possible. It's very possible. I mean, you can sit with someone and play a little game where you will describe the hallucinations for 30 seconds. Then they get to describe the hallucinations for 30 seconds. And you can absolutely convince yourself that people are seeing the same, you know, that you're seeing the same thing. And, you know, when you toss sex into the mix, it just goes over the top. I mean, I've had the impression, I don't want to trot it out as a position of mine or something that I assert as true, but I have had the impression, stoned on mushrooms, making love, that it's like perspiration forms on the surface of the skin, and there's some kind of electrolytic thing that goes on, and the boundaries dissolve between the people. I don't mean metaphorically. I mean that you become one organism, and that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Now, after I just said I don't like taking psychedelics with people, I guess what I should have said is I hate being responsible, because I don't mind taking ayahuasca with 30 people, none of whom speak English, in a hut up some river. But that's because I know that the old shamans are in charge, that I'm just a face in the crowd. Nobody's going to turn to me for explanation or help. I'll tell you an ayahuasca story just to give you an idea of the kind of stuff that goes on in these sessions. Years ago, in 76, Kat and I, it was before we were married, were in Peru, and we had found this shaman who was very good, and he had a following, and we were, you know, apprenticing ourselves to him. And he, the style of these Peruvian mestizo people is that, I mean, cultures handle this differently, but they are never straight with each other. It's an incredibly masked culture, almost like the Japanese, but without the formality. In other words, if you think somebody's a jerk, you would never say that. That's the last thing you would say, because that's your true opinion. So we got into a situation with these people where this elder shaman, who was very respected, beloved even by these people, he had a nephew, a sobrino, who was an absolute jerk. I mean, this guy was into pimping a little on the side, and he was very ambitious to perfect his ayahuasca so he could go to Lima and charge yuppies a bunch of money for taking it and so forth. And he had this really awful habit, and I don't know what was really had gone on before we got there, but they would all get together to take ayahuasca. And these old, old guys, you know, 80, 85 years old, the totally authentic dudes, would sing these beautiful ayahuasca songs. And he would sing against them. I mean, can you imagine a scene like this where everybody's singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, except one guy wants to sing 5'2", Eyes of Blue, and does. And the level of social tension in these meetings would just rise and rise, but nobody would ever say anything to this guy and tell him to bug out and can that crap. So one night, this had happened two meetings in a row, it was the third meeting like this, everybody hoped this guy wouldn't come, so then he showed up, so then we all dose, then we get loaded, and the singing begins, and he begins his singing, and in the wave of hallucinations, and Kat was sitting next to me, he was sitting up on his haunches, kind of rocking back and forth on his heels, and I would look at him, and I could see he was going through these weird animal transformations. First he would become like a jackal, then he would become like a monkey, and it was really intense, and I mentioned it to Kat, and she could see it too. Well, so then he kept, and we were also trying to tape these ayahuasca songs, so it was a double irritation to us that this guy was so out of control. So after a particularly long song by the old guys, with him just hammering against them, I could feel Kat, who has a real Irish temper, getting more and more pissed off at this guy. And finally, at the end of this song, when the silence fell, she had been just staring at the floor, and she looked across the room at Don Jose and gave him a look of pure loathing. And I saw these red things, these red triangular-shaped things, come out of her eyes and go across the room, like... And when it got to him, it knocked him off his feet. He was thrown backwards from the impact of these things, literally. And everything going on in the room stopped dead. And the elder shaman said to the guy sitting next to him, he said, "Oh, the gringa sends the ba-da-da-da-da." And, you know, then you realize, wow, we're in over our heads here. You can't tell shit from shinola in this scene.